The fourth industrial revolution will impact our lives completely. It will not only change how we communicate, how we produce, how we consume, it will change actually us, our own identity, and of course gives life to such policies and developments like smart traffic, smart government, smart cities. What we will see is that everything will be integrated into an ecosystem driven by big data and driven particularly by close cooperation also of governments with business, civil society. And this revolution will come at a breathtaking speed. It will be like a tsunami. And actually, it's not just a digital revolution, it's digital, of course physical, it's nanotechnology, but it's also biological. And those three dimensions provide a particular force to this revolution. So what the World Economic Forum is doing is to promote this public-private cooperation to master the fourth industrial revolution. The fourth industrial revolution will have multifold impacts. Of course, every industry will be digitalized, will be disintermediated, and has to define a new business model.
Who's ready for more Great Reset talk? I'll try to make this one as exciting as the first part. The first part we did, we talked for like 2 hours. That was a bit much, okay. But that was the bulkiest part of this research. And it's a good foundation for what remains in front of us here. The first part we talked about, and of course I'm referring to the Great Reset Part 1, Klaus Schwab, the book club, and the Illuminati globalist agenda. Because of course, as all the great truthers of all time have been telling us, the Chinese communist globalists are come to turn the friggin' frogs gay. So that's what they're doing. And we basically talked about that on part one. And then what follows here, we're going to go, we got a few more parts, right? And I'm only going to do this for the supporters because I love you guys. And this is my best take on it, because I think the truth of community has been talking about the Great Reset for many, many months now, and I didn't fully get the big picture of it, and I had a difficult time trying to find some information that wasn't fear-mongering, so I read the books, and here we go. Here's my notes from the books. But this is part two, transhumanism, 5G, Klaus Schwab, and the fourth industrial revolution. Old Santa Claus is back, and he's got his big German brat, and he's ready to call it an Oktoberfest, and get ready for that. Now, we're also going to do, should you be burned out on Great Reset talk, which I know you're not, because you shouldn't be. We're watching the greatest conspiracy of all time unfold before our eyes, right? Part three, we're going to talk about your boy Jay Dyer. We're going to talk about the World Economic Forum's 8 points and the communist agenda. We're not talking about Jay Dyer, just to be clear. I don't need any truth or drama. He's a friend. I'd like to say he's a friend. And I appreciate his work. I'm just basically using one of his videos where he talked about it, because he sent me a link to when he was on the Fourth Hour of Alex Jones and said, here, watch this one. I watched it. It was about an hour. And even watching it, I thought, I don't know, this seems very fear-mongery to me. So I read the books and I watched his video, and I basically, we're going to go through it point by point. Is he telling the truth? Is he fear-mongering? Hint, he's not. He's not. Oh boy, it's scary times. It's scary. But that's okay. Because you know what? None of us make it out of this thing alive anyway. So who cares? It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Remember that? Remember those prolific words from the great Bill Murray in Meatballs? Well, I do. Okay, part four, we're going to talk about Bill Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse. You're the OG of OGs, the quadruple OG, Bill Cooper, told you this was going to happen in the 80s. And we're going to go over his talking points about why that happened. And then I think I'm going to have a separate fifth show conclusion where we go through all the dilemmas socially about what's happening, what to do about it. Well, I don't know if I'm going to tell you what to do about it. Let me see if I can mull that over. I basically have a rough framework, a skeleton of these shows, and I'm going to populate them with information as we go. But today, part two, old Santa Claus, he's back. I bought his book about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. What's the title? Let me get it for you. Let me find out. Boy, I was just not ready for that. I actually just... I write in my little chicken scratch notes, and I just called it the fourth INDREV. That's what I call it. But yeah, he wrote this book years ago before, let's see. Okay, I'm looking at the Wikipedia. The phrase Fourth Industrial Revolution was first introduced by Klaus Schwab, executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, in a 2015 article. Mastering the Fourth Industrial Revolution was the theme of the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos. Because you'll hear those terms like Davos. It's a place in Switzerland where it's like a Bohemian Grove type deal. Minus the homosexual sacrifice to the owl god, I guess. And then he wrote a book in 2016. That is the book that I read. And it plays a role, and we're not going to go as deep into it like we did with his book, The Great Reset. Let me recap. He wrote a book in, I think it was July of 2020, called COVID-19, The Great Reset, and that's what part one was the notes from that book. But a lot of the research I needed to confirm some of the ideas about The Great Reset that the truthers are presenting comes from a 2016 book that he wrote called The Fourth Industrial Revolution. Now, side note, Santa Claus also has written another book about the Great Reset. I think it just came out in October or November. I haven't read that one yet. I think I've had a gut full of old Santa Claus. But there's more. I mean, you can dig into this thing as you could imagine, as deep down as you want to go. So let's get into the notes, and I'm looking at how many pages I got here. Last time I was a little long-winded. Okay, this shouldn't be so bad. I'm gonna try to keep this one to an hour. So I'll be reading to you from the book with quoted things, but have it be known, I'm gonna paraphrase some parts to speed this thing along. You don't need every blow-by-blow. All right, here we go. In January 2016, the publication of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, that's like the essay they were talking about, called for all of us to take collective responsibility for a future where innovation and technology are centered on humanity and the need to serve the public interest. The new technology age, if shaped in a responsive and responsible manner, could catalyze a new cultural renaissance that will enable us to feel part of something much larger than ourselves, a global civilization. So there you go. I mean, it's right there at the beginning. Globalization. That's what they want. The question is, are they right? I don't think they are. I think they're wrong. The Fourth Industrial Revolution has the potential to robotize humanity and thus compromise our traditional senses of meaning, work, community, family, identity. Or we can use the Fourth Industrial Revolution to lift humanity into a new collective and moral consciousness shared based on a shared sense of destiny. It is incumbent on all of us to make sure that the latter is what happens. Okay, so let me clarify, because it sounded like he was saying he wants to compromise our traditional sources of meaning. He wants to get rid of family, identity, work, community. But here, he very clearly states that he desires to lift humanity into a new collective and moral consciousness based on a shared sense of destiny. So he presents an either-or argument that isn't true, right? It doesn't have to be one of these two. Like, on one hand, the technological innovations and revolutions will be very important, and it will happen. Like, you can't stop it, right? It ain't going to stop. These nerds are going to kill us, and they won't stop until they're done. But he says the fourth industrial revolution has the potential to robotize humanity and compromise traditional sources of meaning. He's saying we don't want to do that. But he kind of does, right? He kind of wants the transhuman movement. But, like, on the surface, he's saying, like, look, instead of us turning into robots, what we need is communism. That's what he says. But in a book, he lays out this vision of, they call it, like, systems leadership. And he's summarizing governance goals and talking about different sectors of technology and how the public needs to exchange ideas with leaders for the sustainable future. And a lot of the ideas he presents, and it's because I studied systems engineering for 2 years in grad school. It's systems thinking, okay? And that's what this guy's all about. That's what Santa Claus is all about. He's talking about global concepts. You take systems thinking, and systems engineering is to consider everything from a higher level of abstraction, right? So, like, for instance, I studied electrical engineering for my bachelor's, and you're, like, you're down in the nitty-gritty of the circuit. You're trying to, like, you know, you activate the transistor and how much current's flowing through the resistor now and blah, 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 blah. Well, like, systems engineering is you take it abstraction levels higher, and you're thinking, okay, so we're producing this much heat on that circuit that we were working on, and how does that affect this other circuit over here, and how does that play into the user experience from a human systems integration standpoint, like all this stuff, right? And that's what Santa Claus is all about. He's like thinking globally. So, like, on some hands, or on some ways, he's not like Dr. Evil. Like, he's not wrong. Like, to him, everything is looking at things from a global perspective. So, yes, he's a globalist. But my thing that I would like to achieve for truthers and you and I and all of us is that this is just one opinion. This is just one piece of information that's going into this equation of what our world will look like. We don't need to follow this guy off the ledge. But some of his ideas we should incorporate, I bet. I think. I don't know. Because, like, he's not full of terrible ideas. But, like, if we blindly follow this globalization thing, that's not good. Like, I believe we need, I like diversity. I think each country is run differently, and that's okay. I don't think that one, I'm not big into empire building. But, like, to me, to think that we're globally going to get together and, like, have free market capitalism in one country and communism in another country, and everything's going to be, you know, evenly distributed and fairly, like, that's just not going to work. That's just me, though. But yeah, you got to understand, Santa Claus is, he's all about systems thinking. And then he asserts that this will not be a minor change. It's a new chapter in human development on par with the first, second, and third industrial revolutions, driven by increasing availability and interaction of extraordinary technologies. This includes 12 clusters of technologies discussed in Section 2. We're talking about AI, robotics, neurotechnologies, biotechnologies, VR, augmented reality, which is AR, right? New materials, ideas, capabilities we don't know yet exist. Now, do you know what this means? We're talking about the aliens, I think. You're talking about new materials. Well, those UFOs are leaving new materials behind, as we're being told. He says, then he lays out sort of a history, which I thought was interesting. He says, over the past 250 years, three industrial revolutions have transformed the way human beings create value and change the world. And each technologies, political systems, social institutions all co-evolved, changing not just industries, but how people saw themselves, related to one another, and interacted with the natural world. Indeed, the way we use the word industrial today is too narrow to encompass the scope of a revolution. A better framing is perhaps the way 19th century thinkers Thomas Carlyle and John Stuart Mill used industry to refer to all activities that flow from human effort. He talks about some examples like how, and what he's saying is like, look, electricity came on the scene. Thomas Edison changed everything. Like, we didn't just now have new gadgets. We now had a new way of life. We had a new way of interacting. We had a new way of everything. I mean, right? You're a smart person. You know what I'm saying? Thomas Edison, by the way, a theosophist and follower of Helena Blavatsky. But that's beside the point. That's beside the point. And he's saying that these, like, disruptors, these disruptive technologies, there's going to be a slew of them coming out. It's like we'll be inventing the light bulb 100 times over with the fourth industrial revolution. And I believe him. He says the process of technological innovation, invention, commercialization, adoption, use has been the most powerful driver of wealth and increased well-being since the beginning of history. Today, the average person has a longer lifespan, better health, more economic security, and a far lower chance of dying through violence than in any prior era. Since the first industrial revolution, the average real income per person has increased around 2,900%. Over the same period, life expectancy at birth has more than doubled in almost every country, from 40 years to more than 80 years in the UK. So he's talking about the first, second, third industrial revolution gave all of us, and it exponentially increases over time, suggesting that the fourth will be even more exponential. What's he saying? Is he saying lifespan increases to infinity? He might be, right? So you see how that works, right? You associate. Because you got to think like a nerd, okay? They're building data and graphs, and they're thinking, okay, every industrial revolution changes so many ways of being, it also increases lifespan. You combine that with the exponential growth of population, and we got a problem. Now, I said this on, I don't know, one of the socials, and they're like, ooh, Isaac, you idiot. There's enough land in Texas to house 8 billion people. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you figured it all out. My bad. I didn't know you had it all figured out. Well, smart guy. Or girl. I don't want to assume genders. The problem they're talking about is natural resources. The problem they're talking about is the pollution and the waste. And they're also, as you didn't know, talking about how the fourth industrial revolution will increase the lifespan of every one of these increasing human population. I can't sit here and mock somebody when I'm stuttering, can I? Can I do that? So that's why these nerds are so obsessed with population control and trying to find ways to manage the increase in population, because not only do they see the population growth, but they see technology giving us the path to immortality. Now, I've always argued that they're the ones that want the immortality. We will not get that sort of treatment. But, you know, that's another argument for another day. And Santa Claus claims that, look, all of us are going to enjoy these new benefits, and we need to make sure that everyone is able to get them, because otherwise my elitist crony buddies, they're going to hoard it all for themselves and live forever, and everyone else is going to die. He says, the first challenge is to ensure that the benefits of the revolution are distributed fairly. The wealth and well-being generated by previous industrial revolutions were and continue to be unevenly distributed. While inequality between countries has reduced considerably since the 70s, due to blah, 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 annual median incomes declined in advanced economies, blah, 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 the United States recorded a reduction in life expectancy for the first time in over 25 years, mainly as a result of the decline in the health of working class whites. People can miss out on benefits of a system for a number of reasons. Maybe they're unavailable, unaffordable, irrelevant. The systems are biased, so on and so forth. At the most alarming level, risks range from attempts at geoengineering that could lead to sudden and irreversible damage to the biosphere, or the development of an artificial general intelligence whose goal-seeking behavior clashes with the diverse messiness of human life. That's what he says, messiness of human life. It's a telling statement they subscribe to. Human beings are messy and we're stupid. We're the cattle. Like Bill Cooper says, we're the cattle. Just meant to be steaks served up on the plate for the elites to control. Here's the son of a bitchin' thing about it. He ain't wrong. Now, you and I, we're not cattle. We're not sheep. But most people are, right? You know them. You love them. They're idiots. They're mouth breathers. And they're listening to every single thing they're told. In fact, even in the truth community, there's lots of those out too. They've put on an archetype and just repeat the thing that the other guy says. Oh, yeah, the thing is the wrong thing. That's because he said it. I said it too. And if you don't say it too, you're an idiot. That's what we do to each other. You know how I hate truthers? I hate truthers as much as... Because at least the mouth breathers, they've got a reason. Like, and I don't blame them. They just remain ignorant. I'm jealous of that. I wish I could just be like, oh, we're being led down the road of tyranny and Chinese global communism. Cool, I'm going to watch this football game. Let me know how that works out for you. I wish, I pray I could be like that, but I'm not. As are you, my friend. We're both in a weird boat full of weirdos. So what I'm saying is Santa Claus isn't wrong. On some levels, these elites aren't wrong. That the masses are a damn mess. The messiness of human life. He then says, the third challenge is to ensure that the revolution is human-led and human-centered. Human values must be respected in themselves rather than weighed in financial terms. Moreover, to be human-centered is to empower rather than determine humans as beings with meaningful agency. So, like, it sounds like he's kind of more or less saying, like, look, the human race and what it is to be human is really at risk here, and we need to make sure that that doesn't go away, which is a good thing, right? And here's where you got to have a sort of tinfoil cap on to read through the lines. Here he says, this challenge is particularly critical because of how the fourth industrial revolution technologies differ from those of the previous industrial revolutions. What he's saying, I believe, and I kind of support this throughout the book when you read, as we'll find out, the new digital technologies, the biotech, are going to be more invasive into our minds and bodies, and we have to be careful with that. And I don't think he's wrong. I think Ray Kurzweil talks about this. I think they desire for this thing to happen, but like the behaviors of the masses and the consumers will make this happen, I assure you. So it's not necessarily their fault. This is just the way it is, which leads me to believe like this is a cyclical nature of mankind. Like we've done this before. I'm not like well versed in that sort of theory, but to me it seems like this is some Tower of Babel type stuff, right? And that's why they warn you in the Bible about this kind of thing. It's like we've done it before. Let's keep reading. To paraphrase Madeleine Albright, we face the task of understanding and governing 21st century technologies with a 20th century mindset through 19th century institutions. It's a big statement there, okay? He says, institutional change is therefore critical to overcoming these challenges, but so is the mindset that we need. He's talking about systems, not technologies. It is tempting to focus on technologies themselves when what really matters are the systems that deliver well-being. With political will, cooperation across stakeholders, new technologies, better performing systems, they could make existing systems. So what he's saying is, he's talking about, like, look, we need to approach this from a systems thinking approach. Instead of being like, oh, cool, look at these Oculus virtual reality goggles, we need to consider elements from a systems view of like how do we incorporate this technology into our lives to make it better without losing identity of what it is to be human. So like a lot of the critiques against Santa Claus as being this anti-humanist, transhumanist, in some ways he's looking out for us, it seems, reading the book. I don't, and this is where it gets real insidious, because like I don't know that that's what when you read it on the surface, is what it seems like. But everything else tells me it ain't, that ain't it, Chief. All right, he talks more about design thinking, keeping human-centered design, which again, this is systems engineering. They call it HSI, human systems integration. When you design a system, you think about the human, right? So if you're, building a refrigerator, you think about how does a human being typically open a door? What do they normally do when they go in the door? How long do they leave it open? Like, you think about these things. Or you're supposed to, at least. I think the better pieces of technology do, like Dyson, right? Dyson does this very well. Apple does this very well, or they used to, at least. You bake in these higher philosophies into the system as you go along. That's kind of what he's saying. He's like, look, these technologies are coming. The idiots don't see the train coming, but it's coming. We need to make sure we keep a higher perspective of what these technologies are going to do to us as human beings, because they're going to become a fast and furious, folks. If you read I think it was my first book, we talked about Moore's Law. I talk about it all the time, about how technology and speeds increase over time, basically, exponentially. And much like how human progress increases exponentially, so will the technologies. We're going to be bombarded with things that were pure science fiction at a much higher clip than we're used to. And that's all Santa Claus is saying, is like, let's keep a higher perspective in mind. I mean, he steers it down the path of communism, where he's like, we need to make sure these technologies get in the hands of everyone, because it gives an unfair advantage to too many people. And we've already got a wealth disparity problem in the country. We don't want to make it worse. Is that true, though? Is that true, Santa Claus? You don't want to make it worse? I thought about how curious it is. I keep calling him Santa Claus, and it is December. So Santa Claus is coming. All right, let me keep reading here. Focusing. Okay, again, he's talking about a lot of... I can skip past a lot of these. I mean, I got a lot of notes here. He keeps harping on the systems thinking. He talks about minimum viable appreciation. Okay, I'll read you that part. He says, this is a challenge that many of us face, two-pronged approach to overcome. Learning just enough about each of the technologies and attaining a minimal viable appreciation to be able to place them in a bigger picture is the first prong of the approach. Right? I live by that. You know, like, and here's an example. You could get swamped down in every detail of how your phone works. I mean, it's got a massive manual, or at least they used to give you manuals, but you know what I'm saying. Everything you buy used to come with like these giant manuals of every little nitty-gritty detail. Or you could just get the basics. The quick start guide, right? They gave you the quick start guide because that's your minimal viable approach. Appreciation, I'm sorry. Maximum efficiency. Don't read the whole manual. Just read the quick start. If you need the deep dive, then you get into it. You, my listener, my great supporter, that's what you're doing right now. You don't want to read all of Santa Claus's books. Hell no. You want to get the minimum viable appreciation. So you come to your boy Isaac and I tell you what I think, and I'm probably wrong. You need to fact check. But what I'm saying, if you want to go deeper, if you want to be obsessed with this, by all means, buy the books and go deep as you want to go. I'm just giving you a quick hot take. Let's see what else we got. Let's see what else old Santa Claus talks about. Okay, so he starts talking about the technologies, right? And this is where things are interesting. He says, the phenomenon of reemergence is becoming a common consumer experience as companies build these new capabilities into their products and services. UPS now offers 3D printing and scanning, targeting customers looking to build prototypes, creating models and personal accessories without the need of the expensive computer-controlled machines. Fourth Industrial Revolution technologies will not stop at becoming part of the physical world around us. They will become part of us. Indeed, some of us already feel that our smartphones have become an extension of ourselves. Today's external devices, from wearable computers to VR headsets, will almost certainly become implantable into the body and brain. Exoskeletons and prosthetics will increase our physical power while advances in neurotechnology enhance the cognitive abilities. This is like basically every sci-fi movie you've ever seen, right? We will become better able to manipulate our own genes and those of our children. These developments raise profound questions. Where do we draw the line between human and machine? What does it mean to be human? He's saying that the reemergence means that the third revolution was taking physical mediums and converting them to digital, right? Like, we went from cassettes to MP3 files. Well, CDs, right? We went from CDs to MP3 files. Took the physical, converted to digital. That was a revolution. Changed everything. Well, the fourth industrial revolution will go the other way. This is an important point here, okay? So listen up. I don't know what you're doing right now, but listen up. What he's saying is that this fourth industrial revolution is about manifesting reality from the ether. We're going from digital MP3s back to CDs. Right? Isn't that weird? That's what he's talking about with these 3D printers. You're taking an idea and creating reality. You're manifesting reality from your thoughts. We're all magicians. When Aleister Crowley talked about the Aeon of Horus and the Age of Magical Thinking, this is kind of it. The technology enables that. Manifesting reality, and it will require some form of transhumanism. He then talks about the jobs of new industries demanding technical expertise and non-cognitive skills, posing challenges for lower skilled workers. He talks about how the new economic activities are for the gig economy, which is like everyone's an independent contractor doing side hustles, Ubering around, DoorDashing around or whatever. And listen to this. In the United States, 94% of new jobs created between 2005 and 2015 are in alternative forms of work. Lacking social protection, labor rights, or even meaningful control on the part of workers. The fourth industrial technologies therefore appear to be undermining humans' choice and ability to apply their skills and interests to meaningful work and may lead to generations of workers living precarious and fragmented lives. To put it simply, the clear goal for achieving well-being in the fourth industrial revolution is a focus on a human-centered agenda. If the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution result in a future of increased inequality, poverty, blah, 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 environment damage, if they result in human beings being marginalized, appropriated, or devalued, things have gone wrong. Well-known economists, such as some people, I can't pronounce their names, have popularized the notion of the great decoupling of labor from productivity due to technology and the gig economy enabled by the technology. It's expected to reach 40% of all jobs by 2020. He wrote this book 4 years ago, right? Almost half of the jobs are gig economy jobs. And it's true, right? This outdated way of thinking that, you know, oh, everyone's got 40 hours precisely of work to do in a week. That's what Tim Ferriss was talking about in his book, 4-Hour Work Week. Like, it just ain't true. No God out there was like, every job requires exactly 40 hours of work. That's why we go to work 40 hours a week. I mean, back in the day, like when you had everyone was working in a factory, like sure, like more hours is more productivity, but that's just not the way it works. And the teleworking has opened up the eyes of millions. Again, this is a reason why we talk about a new normal and a great reset. It's because these things have presented themselves into our reality. Now you've people who didn't have the foresight to think about these things, like how you could telework, are now like, oh, we could telework. Think about the ripple effects of that. All these businesses with locations are going to shut down. All those, what are they called? WeWork, those centers where people just show up once in a while when they need to have a meeting. That'll be more prominent. How do you invest in that? Someone invest in that for me, okay? Buy me a couple shares, and then when you're rich, send some over to your boy. But yeah, this is all stuff he's talking about. The Great Reset, the new normal. There's too many ripple effects that are going to happen. And the technology increasing exponentially the way it is not going to help matters any. So we need to wrap our minds around this idea because it's happening. Trust you me, the world will change at a rate that will be unimaginable. Are we going to have flying cars? I don't know. I mean, who knows, right? But again, a whole chapter here devoted to embedding social values into these technologies that are coming out. He's talking about ethics requirements for college degrees, which I myself had some ethics stuff. So they've been doing that. The company shouldn't just have a regulation checklist. He says, we as humans need to evolve to be better, to make sure that everything is considered. And he talks about societal benefits of these emerging technologies. Talking about self-driving vehicles. Let's see. That would lead to lower emissions, less congestion, faster rides, fewer deaths, fewer accidents. And the rollouts need to be... Oh boy, I mean, there's a lot here. The rollout of new techniques within precision medicine to treat and manage non-communicable diseases could easily extend lifespans around the world by 1 to 2 years, even without considering current attempts to use gene editing techniques to slow aging directly. Gene editing has other revolutionary abilities, one being the potential to end diseases like malaria by genetically engineering the malaria mosquito. Now, your boy Bill Gates did that, didn't he? Didn't he unleash some kind of genetically modified mosquito that'll kill off other mosquitoes? Blockchain technology can be applied for public land registration, enabling millions of people around the world to have formal ownership over their land, which in turn can be used as collateral and allow them to access financial markets. VR, AR will improve education. I mean, he goes through a bunch of like sci-fi examples, okay? You get the picture. Then, let's see, he says, freedoms empower people and give them capabilities to live good lives, whether in a wealthy or developing society. Distribution of wealth and benefits does not need to be equal among all stakeholders, but it must be sufficient for all stakeholders to live a life they reason to value. Now, previously, he was laying out the argument that the first, second, third industrial revolution, it never even got to much of the world. Believe that, right? Like right now, half of the world doesn't even have internet. They don't even know it's Christmas. They don't have the internet in half the world. That's why Elon Musk is shooting satellites out in space. Starlink. But he says explicitly, it does not have to be equal distribution. So don't listen to all of the fear tactics that the truthers are putting out there. It's a little bit out of reality. I mean, like, I think maybe he would pursue that, but that's like what he does. But he right there, he clearly says, much like in the Great Reset book, he kind of lays out the idea that America and China don't have to come to the table for the same thing. So like, he's not entirely 100% wrong or out of sync with reality. But in the next section, he starts talking about the exponential increases. How much of this do you want to hear? You want to hear all of it, don't you? I'll give it to you. He says, the unparalleled wealth generated by nearly 3 centuries of industrialization has not only been unevenly spread amongst the people, but has come at a significant cost to Mother Earth, with a list of things. Species are going extinct at 100 times natural levels. In 1800, only 3% of the world population of 1 billion lived in urban areas. Today, more than 50% of the world's 7.4 billion inhabitants live in urban areas. Of these, more than 92% experience air pollution above levels deemed safe by the World Health Organization. By 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the oceans. By weight. Global CO2 emissions have risen 150-fold since 1850. And at the current rate of emissions, the risk would be a 4 to 6 degrees Celsius warmer by 2100 than it is today, irreversible damage, so on and so forth. Now, when they talk about like 1 degree of or 4 degrees here, for example, of increase, you think, oh, well, it's going to be 4 degrees warmer? Who cares? No, the problem is that they're talking about global average temperatures, right? And when you shift globally by 1 degree, 4 degrees, like that's a huge deal. And don't ask me, I'm not an environmental engineer or whatever, but that's a real thing, right? So when they talk about 1 or 2 degrees, like don't think, oh, it's going to be a degree warmer, I'll take that, cool. No, I mean, it's talking about a global average, like it's a huge, huge swings on macro levels. Some areas where it's warmer is going to be cooler, cooler, warmer, all that stuff. He talks about climate change disrupting economies, geopolitical instability, mass migration, food production problems, security threats. And this, my friends, is why he's always talking about the depopulation agenda. That's why you hear about it. Let's see. And he basically is like talking about all these things we got to do. He's talking about the technologies. He talks about new forms of automation, including robots and algorithms driven by recent advances in AI, are not just replacing factory workers, but accountants, lawyers, and other professional workers. In 2000, Goldman Sachs' New York office employed 600 traders. In 2017, only 2 equity traders were left. And that's something. And everyone has that argument about how, oh, we can't increase the cost of minimum wage. Now it'll force employers to lay off their employees. Well, that's not really true, is it? McDonald's already started doing it. They didn't increase the minimum wage. They want to replace you with a robot. Trust in that. They invest in robots to save money. I mean, look at that Goldman Sachs. Look at Wall Street. All shifting. You heard it right there. In 2000, Goldman Sachs had 600 traders. In 2017, they had 2. It's probably 0 now. Probably 1 just to keep the robot happy. Entertain the robot while the robot does all the work. And here's an interesting point. For the past 250 years, community, identity, purpose, and agency have been closely linked with our roles as laborers or productive members of society. Current disruptions are forcing political leaders to rethink the paradigm that shapes the relations among individual, society, and economic activity. This includes considering reforms for reshaping the social contracts. The discussion of a universal basic income is one example of this conversation. Do you remember David Icke? He talked about this whole, people would ask, oh, who are you? Hi, who are you? And I'm screwing this up. But like people introduce themselves, they're like, oh, hi, I'm Johnny. I'm the plumber. And, you know, and David Icke's like, no, you're not a plumber. You're infinite consciousness, buddy. Put on your chakra t-shirt. Light them chakras up. Do a dance. Get your granola mushrooms out. You're infinite consciousness. Start acting like it. But now, universal basic income, I know your ears perked up for that. Let's talk about what he says in the book on that. He says, it's a radical idea being tested across the world from Finland to Kenya, California, India. Beyond rational and distributive arguments, the primary justification for UBI is social justice. As income increasingly goes towards land, natural resources, and intellectual property, all parts of society's collective wealth, everyone should have a modest share of this collective wealth in the form of unconditional basic income. Did you hear that? Ain't that a bitch talking about how the primary justification is social justice as income increasingly goes towards land, natural resources, intellectual property. You remember... And look, I'm not an expert on this, and this is a subject I shouldn't really get into, but we're going to. I wouldn't put this on the free feed. I don't trust those clowns with this information. Like, think about how African Americans talk about reparations, getting paid for being. I mean, they were set back. They were bought over on slave ships. Their families were screwed with, broken up. Abused horribly, set back 300 years because of how we treated them, and they've been saying, look, we need some reparations checks to catch up with the rest of you guys. And then everyone in America is like, nah, I don't think so. You need to pick yourself up by your bootstraps. And then here comes UBI. Here comes Universal Basic Income. He says it right there. The primary justification is social justice. Talking about how income is going towards land, natural resources, and so on. It's the collective wealth of society. So now they're okay with this is like white people reparations, isn't it? Like now that it's scary for the white people, now we got to think about it. I don't know. I don't have a lot of good homework for you on that. That's just some thoughts that the stream of consciousness that came into my mind. My fragile white snowflake mind. My white guilt brain. All right, here we go. Let's keep reading, right? Let's move on. Women account for fewer than 30% of those employed in scientific research. Less than 25% of IT jobs held by women. Proportion is even lower among tech entrepreneurs. Basically, he's laying out this argument that women were held back in the first and second industrial revolution, and it's looking like it's going to happen in the fourth as well. And why is that? Well, it's not like an insidious thing. It's because people who are into this digital stuff, nerds, are more apt to embrace and be ahead of the rest who aren't into this stuff. Like, how many women do you know into cryptocurrencies? Probably not a lot. You probably know a lot of male nerds into cryptos. Because women are less into digital. They're less into science. And, you can get into, social narratives, cultural models. Why is that? Were they told this from being a child that they shouldn't be into it or whatever? I don't know. And he's just saying, look, we need to focus to make sure we bring women into the fold so they don't get left behind. He's looking out for you. I mean, on the surface, he's looking out for all of us. He's saying, look, this new industrial revolution is going to bring about rapid changes. We need to make sure we don't lose people in the dust. Everyone needs to be brought along on this ride. Thus, while humanoid robots in theory could transcend categories such as race and gender when designed, most often we see customer service robots designed around female characteristics, whereas industrial robots are more often modeled around male characteristics. Isn't that interesting? Altering the human, and isn't that what Siri and Alexa, they're all females. Why do we choose females to be these servants? I don't know. Are they more relaxing? Like, is it more relaxing to us to hear that? Is that a good thing, maybe? Is that a bad thing? Is that acting like women are subservient to men? I don't know. I haven't read the studies. There's a reason they do it, though. He talks about transhumanism here. Okay, here we go. Finally, getting into transhumanism. Altering the human being, section 2.3. The lines between technologies and human beings are becoming blurred, not just by the ability to create lifelike robots. Instead, it's about the ability of new technologies to literally become part of us. Technologies already influence how we understand ourselves, how we think about each other, how we determine our realities. As the technologies in this section give us deeper access to part of ourselves, we may begin to integrate digital technology into our body. The metaphor of the cyborg may seem to have lost its ability to shock, but the future may see mixes of digital and analog life that will redefine our very nature. He's going to talk about biotech, neurotechnology, brain science, VR, AR, all these things. All these things are going to challenge us. It says digital computing capabilities were the general purpose technology behind the third industrial revolution, thanks to exponential reductions in the size and cost of transistors since their invention in 1947. Quick side note, that's what I told you with Moore's Law, right? It's essentially what he's talking about. And a lot of people talk about, and this came up on Joe Rogan. Was it Joe Rogan? With Jacques Vallée? They talked about the transistor. And I think it was Jacques Vallée. And your boy was right. I remember hearing it because that's the big, you always hear that argument. Oh my God. See, what happened was the UFO crash in Roswell in 1947. Then that same year, they invented transistors. You see? The transistor was alien technology. No, not true. Not true. I learned this in college, and college would never lie to me. It would not indoctrinate me. But officially, transistors evolved from vacuum tubes, states of 0 and 1, on or off, okay? Essentially what they are. Not alien artifacts. And the patents for field effect transistors, it goes back to, I think, the 20s or the 30s. And he's talking about the transistors. He says, today, transistors are already smaller than viruses. 14 nanometers is currently the smallest one. 10 nanometer chips are coming into production. Intel's producing a 7 nanometer chip. And oh, by the way, human error is 50,000 nanometers in diameter. So they're going to have a 7 nanometer chip. Your human hair is 50,000 nanometers in diameter. Can you even wrap your mind around that? No, you can't. That's what he's saying. Fourth Industrial Revolution. Let's see. Here we go. Okay, as Mark Weiser wrote in 1991, the most profound technologies are those that disappear. They weave themselves into the fabric of everyday life until they are indistinguishable from it. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? The most profound technologies are those that disappear. Like, for instance, a car. They now have all these computers in them. But there was a time many years ago where a computer was a computer and a car was a car. And you wouldn't sell a car today and say, well, you see, the car's got a computer. Look at this computer it's got. You wouldn't talk about it. It's just part of the car now. Right? You get what he's saying there? Isn't that insane? Let's see. I think he gives some examples here. Computers that are more than just an important part of new cars. That's where I got the idea from, probably. Part of new cars, consumer electronics, and most home appliances. They are now integrated into textiles and clothing and are being built into the infrastructure that surrounds us in roads, streetlights, bridges, and buildings. We live in a computer-built world. Then he talks about Facebook, basically. You probably know this experiment they did where they were having someone through neural technologies dictate commands and thoughts onto a computer just by thinking them. And then he talks about the challenge and the issues with it, DNA. Let me redo that because I thought this was interesting. The increases in possibilities for the two-way flow of info between us and our environment highlights the challenge of a continually expanding bandwidth as well as improving compression technology. The vast amounts of data created in a digitally driven world require new approaches that offer dense, long-term storage. One solution is using DNA to store information. Some guy demonstrated the possibility of storing data on DNA at more than 100,000 times the density of the best flash memory available. It's also stable at a wide range of temperatures. You can drop it wherever you want, in the desert or your backyard, it'll be there 400,000 years later. So they're talking about data being stored more safely and efficiently on your DNA. Is that scary? Yes, it is. Then he talks about blockchain. He says, by the 2030s, versions of blockchains, which they call distributed ledger technology, may well change everything from online financial transactions to the way we vote to where goods are produced. And we talked about this in great detail in my book, Conspiracy Theories in Unpopular Culture, and it was also on the podcast. I believe it was 2018. I talked about Bitcoin and cryptos. I think it was two shows, maybe. But the technology is the promising thing, not necessarily one crypto over another, because the blockchain is this decentralized way of storing and executing data in this new revolution. And this is important. They think this is a sort of the most trustable thing ever. The trusted third party recording all the transactions. That way anyone can see it at any time. You know, you give your bank $100 to deposit and they'll give you a receipt. But if you lost that receipt, you'd be like, hey, I gave you $100. Where is it? And you'd go in and they would look on their little ledger and be like, oh, okay, yeah, we got a receipt here. $100 right there. But what if they lost theirs and you lost yours? Done. blockchain is there forever. And I went through my whole spiel on Bitcoins and cryptos, and I do think, like, I mean, for sure, it's the way of the future. They need to figure out a better way to integrate it with the masses, because it's very confusing to work as of today. And here's the son of a bitching part about it. They transfer the risk from the bank to you. And also on top of that, you fund every transaction. Doesn't that suck? I think it sucks. I hate it. You change phones and you lose your 25-word password. Oh, sorry. Your cryptos are gone forever, and there's no one to call. There's no one to argue with. There's no insurance behind it. It's got, I don't trust it. I don't like it in its current form. I know people are like, yeah, but you cut the banks out of it. Like, cool, I don't care. The bank makes their money, but, like, I know I've got some customer service there. I know that, like, if just because I lose my phone doesn't mean I'm going to be locked out of my account forever and lose all my money. Okay. Yeah, and he's basically praising blockchain for a lot. Okay, but, oh, here we go, and this speaks to my point. He says, perhaps most challenging conceptually is the loss of central authority. This challenge is more than institutional. It's deeply psychological and attached to systems of human order. Decentralizing trust by relying on a complex set of algorithms is as radical as the shift from human deduction as the ultimate source of knowledge to reliance on scientific instrumentation. It took society centuries to adapt to the latter, though economic incentives may catalyze the former. Ultimately, with the blockchain, trust will have to lie within the mathematicians and the infrastructure rather than politicians and individual recognizable institutions. This raises existential challenges. Basically, nerds. You got to trust the nerds. And who shouldn't we trust? You know. The nerds. But that's what he's saying, the way of the future. And I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. He says, blockchain can benefit individuals by giving them more secure, collaborative ways of generating and transferring value. And he's talking about, like, now you got these third world countries that just got a cell phone and the internet for the first time, and they don't have banks. It's like, okay, cool. Good for them. It's kind of like health and vaccines, right? Like, of course, there's some countries and some areas where they need that. You know, they might need the polio vaccine because they're bathing in rivers full of their own feces because they don't have plumbing. Okay, cool. Give it to them. I don't want it. Same with blockchain. Oh, they don't have access to banks and they need a way of transferring value? Cool. Give them the blockchain. I don't want it. And look, I'm just using that as an example. I'm not defending banks. It says, in the next decade, more than 80 billion connected devices around the world will be in constant communication with people and each other. And that's where he starts talking about the Internet of Things and 5G again. See my book, Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture, or the shows. I did the shows, you know. These are all about 5G. There's like two or three shows for that. Examples, supermarkets will no longer have checkout facilities. Fast food restaurants will have less than half the staff they had 10 years ago. As business models take advantage of the Internet of Things to optimize their operations and create a pool economy, the world around us continuously anticipates our needs by analyzing our patterns of behavior. In this future, we will become more conscious of the value of our data and more concerned about digital security. And you know where this is going, right? Like, they're stealing your data. And now you know why, because they're going to have 80 billion devices talking to each other to try to sell you stuff. That's what it's all about. And spy on you and keep crime down and all this stuff. In fact, right here, he said, public crime is likely to decrease due to the convergence of sensors, cameras, AI, and facial recognition software. And like we always say, it's your privacy in exchange for the illusion of safety. Because I'd argue that, sure, crime will go down. But, like, is it true? Are they going to make some false arrest? Is that counter having your own privacy? I don't think so. He talks about how this is revolution, not evolution, and the Internet of Things. Let's see. In particular, there are entirely new business models to be discovered. The most obvious, often called the outcome economy, is the transition to the purchase of outcomes by the hour or by the meter or by the liter. And he's talking about like the idea that you go on contract. This is the 40-hour work week thing. In the way of the future, which thank God, they're going to be like, look, you just need to do this amount of work. However long that takes you, that's all we need you to do. If it takes you 20 hours, 40 hours, 80 hours, we don't care. Just get it done. I also foresee them, employers, transferring the cost of assets, computers, all that stuff to you. I feel like you're going to be the one buying your software and your computers to telework and all that. And I'm all for that. I'm actually okay with that. Because, like, you save me from having to go into an office? I'll buy whatever computer you want me to buy, old buddy. Okay, and then he talks about, let's see what's more important here. Because we're running out of time. We're running out of time. The 21st century goals for AI include helping autonomous machinery to navigate the physical world, helping humans and computers to interrelate. Now, here's what you have to understand about AI. In its current form, and he distinguishes generalized AI versus specific AI. Right now, all we really got is specific AI, where you program a computer and say, sift through all this data and pull out all this information. And it can do it incredibly fast on its own. That's kind of where we're at. We're very far from a Skynet type of thing. That's your generalized AI. And that's basically what he talks about. He talks about how AI is monitoring the data and the sensor networks. Like, that's the current sort of thing about it. And basically, Minority Report is coming, right? And then he talks about how all these big companies have been, you know, researching AI, incorporating AI. It's going to fit into automated trucking. You listening, Skinny Fresh, my man out there on the truck? Listen to this. In many areas of the economy, increased automation may create new types of jobs while rendering others obsolete. Automated trucking, for example, is likely to lead to job losses across the logistics industry. And he's talking about AI replacing, I mean, isn't that sound bonkers? No one's going to drive anymore? Big rigs driving down the road by themselves? That's scary sounding, right? Again, this is what he's talking about. This is the revolution. And it's going to blow everyone's mind. And he's saying, we need to make sure we don't leave too many people behind. Let's see, 10 things everyone should know about AI. And he basically just talks more about sensors and how they're going to use AI to monitor the environment and pollution. I mean, the whole book, Dr. Santa Claus here, he does good to highlight the pros and cons to all these ideas. So, like, on some levels, I don't get the vibe that he's this Dr. Evil orchestrator. I think he's just pointing out what is. And he's saying we need to incorporate technology in a fair manner. But, as you could see, that leads to the Chinese communist globalism, which is the ultimate enemy, apparently. And I don't disagree with that. I'm all for every country going at it on their own. Let's see. Biotechnologies will change the future and they will change us. Here we go. More transhuman talk. Firms are already engineering bacteria to produce everything from resins to personal care products. And Chinese scientists have used CRISPR to combat cancer. Mitochondrial replacement therapy. A bunch of nerd stuff. I don't know what he's talking about. In vitro fertilization. Oh, and by the way, I think it's in vitro. Do you know that there's more aborted fetuses at in vitro clinics than at abortion clinics and Planned Parenthood clinics? So the next time you see people out there losing their damn minds at Planned Parenthood and abortion clinics, you tell them they better pick up their little signs and go over to the in vitro fertilization clinics, because they're aborting fetuses like 5 times the rate. But you see how we're controlled and social constructs are forcing people to do things that, like, they're just under the spell. They're under the magical spell. Anyway, I just thought he talked about this thing. Anyway, I'm trying to add a little bit of side fun notes because, I mean, it's dry material, right? And what's more fun than talking about abortion, right? Yeah, good times. not terrible. Okay, let me keep reading here. Jeez Louise. Pessimists warn of a dystopian future of designer babies and unequal access to the fruits of biotech. These opposing views highlight the debate about how to use new biotech capabilities and underscore the complex questions. Biotech differs in three significant ways from other enabling technologies of the revolution. First, it evokes more emotive responses than changes caused by digital technology. In particular, technology that alters biological systems causes unease in many people who see manipulating DNA as courting danger. And they talked about like controversies of stem cell research and all that stuff. It says agriculture is the second major area where biotech has enormous potential to feed the world in the next 50 years. Oh, this is good. This is a good, let me highlight this one. This one's pretty good. I thought if he's telling the truth. To feed the world in the next 50 years, we will need to produce as much food as was produced in the last 10,000 years. That blow your mind? If he's telling the truth. So again, some more investment advice, and I'm not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. Maybe invest in those plant-based meats. That's what Bill Gates is doing, right? I don't think they're wrong. I don't think they're wrong. A classic example is golden rice, enriched rice that could eliminate childhood blindness and developmental defects that lead to the deaths of almost 2 million children every year because of vitamin A deficiency. Did you know that happens? Good Lord. You know, you want to talk about the kids and protecting the kids, like, I guess give them the GMO rice. I don't know. Agriculture also is likely to be impacted by dedicated hardware such as soil and weather sensors. Again, he's talking about sensors and data crap. And he's talking about managing the crops and the GMOs and all that stuff. And again, this is, you know, this is his defense of GMOs, which, look, again, just like I was arguing with the polio vaccines and the blockchain. Look, some of these third world countries, this is game changers for them. Like, we don't really have a lot of these problems in the first world countries. So, like, stay away from me with the GMOs. I don't want it. Maybe that's an elitist attitude. Maybe I need to check my privilege. Okay, maybe. Given the power of biotech, many worry that it will be the root of an unexpected societal and environmental problems, especially as we extend the capacity of humanity to intervene and assert control over the biological realm. He thinks that all we've got to do with all this crazy biotech being unleashed upon us is to regulate the industries. These biotech companies are going to do this research anyhow, so let's put some rules down so the nerds don't kill us. And then later he'll say, we need to base these rules on the UN Sustainable Development Goals. That's the 2030 stuff we were talking about a few shows back. Neurotechnologies, he talks about how we're going to influence consciousness and thought and reality through neurotech. This is like Elon Musk's Neuralink stuff. And a good warning here about big tech getting deeper into the manipulation of the mind. It says, neurotechnologies matter for three reasons. First, the ability to read and write to the brain heralds new industries and systems for value creation, which will have deep social, political, and economic impacts. The ability to correct deficiencies and add enhancements will be a huge boon for those wealthy enough to buy or sell neurotech. At the same time, the ability to access a person's innermost thoughts and influence his or her thinking is a huge concern. Talking about algorithms and the data collection, right? Could the next trending business model involve someone trading access to his or her thoughts for the time-saving option of typing a social media post by thought alone? Wow, what's he talking about, man? A little bit like Inception, right? Just like, here's access to my brain. Get in there. Save me some time so I don't have to spill out, you know, text on a screen or whatever. He talks about how the brain works, you know, how neurotech's going to be a, let's see, what does he say? These abilities may be closer to reality than we think. Elon Musk announced his investment in a company focused on developing brain-computer interfaces, arguing that he foresees a closer merger of biological intelligence and digital intelligence. That's the Neuralink. It's coming for you. But then, of course, you know, there's these brain disorders affecting all these people that they're going to use, right? They're going to use that to push these biotechs. And of course, they're going to be saying, oh, here's how you cure depression. Instead of a pill, we're going to rewire your brain. When in reality, and again, this goes back to the same argument. Cool, if you're like living in a third world country where you need that, great. I'm happy for that. But like, you've got options. You got therapy, right? I got a sponsor for the free feed, BetterHelp. It's about therapy. You can process the stuff the old-fashioned way, but people don't want to. They want to take the pill. They want to rewire the brain. They're just giving you what you want, aren't they? People want the fast food. They want the McDonald's. They're just giving them the GMO garbage they're asking for. You vote with your dollar. It's like everything else. You can choose to be healthy, eat clean, or eat the GMO. And then you're sick, your immune system's compromised, and then they're like, oh, let's protect your life, let's stab you with the cure, whatever big money scheme they got in the stabbies. That's what they're going to do with the big COVID thing, right? Which is why, like, I'm a big supporter of, like, look, you shouldn't have to take this damn thing. That's an invasion of, that's my, what do they say, my body, my choice. I'm a big supporter of that on all levels, okay? Let's see. What else do we got? We're almost done. Oh, interesting part. He talks about, I don't know if you remember in the 90s, they had virtual reality and then like it didn't seem to do anything. It's because it was too ahead of its time. They had to let Moore's Law catch up and process data to handle the high resolution imagery that fast. That's why it took so long to take off. Curious, huh? Do you remember, let's just, we're almost done. Talk about VR, right? Virtual reality technologies are more than new ways of experiencing digital environments. They represent platforms and systems where value can be created, exchanged, and distributed. Basically saying you could live in this virtual reality world. So be on the lookout for that, right? If there's a social media of a virtual reality kind, like, I'm getting in there right off the bat. I'm building up my followers. Because I think it's going to be the next thing, right? That's what's going to put Facebook out of business. Probably why they bought Oculus. They probably see that too. Offering a completely new channel for perceiving and interacting with the world makes them one of the most transformative technologies. However, their immersive nature means that even more than other digital channels, they blur the lines between artificial technology, the external world, and the role of human intuition and agency by changing how we interact with the internet and digital environments. It changes how the humans experience the world. This is just like the film Surrogates with Bruce Willis that was in my first book, A Grand Unified Conspiracy Theory, which, I don't know if you know, you sign up for my email newsletter, you get it for free. Give you a little free copy of the ebook of that on IlluminatiWatcher.com/start. Yeah, the film Surrogate, that shows you what they're working on. You live inside this little VR thing, you go to work with your avatar, and that's where you basically live. That's where we're heading. Talks about renewable energy. It says, in 2016, for the first time, renewables accounted for more than half of new power production, but still only 10% of the overall. So again, their argument for population reduction. There's not enough renewable energy sources to make up the energy that we need. You want to hear about chemtrails? He talks a little bit about this. He says, geoengineering. It's the idea that humans can successfully control the behavior of Earth's highly complex biosphere. Many scientists see technologies that purport to intervene in this space as immature and insecure at best, existentially threatening at worst, consequences both unforeseeable and unmanageable. Well, good. Thank God, right? And then later on he says, proposals include installing giant mirrors in the stratosphere to deflect the sun's rays, chemically seeding the atmosphere to increase rainfall, and the deployment of large machines to remove carbon dioxide from the air. So at least this nerd in particular is telling us to proceed with caution, okay? Then he's talking about cooling the planet, reflecting radiation back to space. And in the book, he has an essay about seeding the atmosphere with nanoparticles. So, again, he's not necessarily advocating for all these things. He's just talking about them. Like, the reality is that people are considering these things. And he's, I mean, if nothing else, like, on some level, Santa Claus is, like, warning us about, like, hey, let's be careful with this. And then finally, last quote, and we're done. Last note. Systems leadership is neither a call for top-down control, nor for subtle influence by powerful groups, but rather a paradigm that empowers all citizens to organize and innovate, invest, and deliver value in the context of a mutual accountability and collaboration. Well, there you go. Doesn't sound so bad, huh? So again, I read this book and I was left with some conflicting ideas, thinking, I don't know if Santa Claus is so bad. But the problem is, like, and that's why it's so insidious, because on the surface, a lot of these things, you're like, yeah, it's true. Like, he's not coming up, he's not making this up. Like, this is all happening. And mostly it's happening because there's demand for this sort of thing in, to make money. Because that's the double-edged sword of free market capitalism. But here's the problem. The problem is those truthers, I think they're telling the truth. And that's where we'll come back with part three. We're going to talk about the World Economic Forum's 8 points and the communist agenda. Talk about Jay Dyer's Great Reset talk on Alex Jones. And then on the next episode after that, we'll talk about Bill Cooper. He said all this stuff in Behold a Pale Horse. And I'm sorry, I believe these guys. I do. I believe them. I mean, sometimes at some point, you got to put your faith in something. And I trust Bill Cooper and Jay Dyer more than I trust Santa Claus. So there you go. Hope you enjoyed that. Thank you for your support on Patreon and Rockfin. And until next time, stay woke.